Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, I recognize that music. It's time for me to start talking. Listen, I'm here live. It's real time happening. Oh, there's about a 3-second delay, but that's okay. We're here this week. We're here to answer your questions. It'll be fun. We do this most Sunday mornings, don't we? Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast, for Alabama. Good to tune in. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately because I've gotten some questions about companion planting. And I hate to use the word too much because I'm just gonna throw this balloon up and then I'm gonna shoot it out of the sky. So I just we'll talk about companion planting. Just, you know, I don't know if you've heard all this stuff, and I get a lot of calls saying, oh, you know, if I plant my carrots next to my tomatoes, my carrots are gonna do better, and my tomatoes, no. No, and garlic is not going to help your roses. And I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there. This is the internet, remember? And, you know, even before the internet, there were books, and people could say whatever they really wanted to say, regardless of whether they had any basis for saying it. It's the way things work. It's the way things work. And so I thought, well, companion plant sounds like an interesting idea. Maybe I should explore it. And nothing ever seemed to work for me the way they said it would work at all. And then the research started coming in, and basically there's not much to it, if there's anything to it at all. And I have to say this because I want you to understand what I'm about to say now. Companion planting, finding a pair of things that will somehow you could plant together in a way that's going to make each of them grow better, it really doesn't work out quite that way. It doesn't work out quite that way. I mean, there's some exceptions. But really, I think what we want to think about is not something called companion planting, but community planting. And I'm not talking about community gardening. I'm not talking about bringing in a whole bunch of people and trying to figure out how you're going to find a bed space for each of them and figuring out what to do when somebody doesn't weed their beds and somebody else has got to do it and when somebody uses pesticides. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about creating a community of plants and how important that is to your garden. And it's clearly important to your yard generally and broadly speaking. And I have to bring it up because we have gone the opposite direction. We do crazy things. We do crazy things. Lawns. Do you want to know why you will never, ever, ever, under any circumstance, have a lawn, a big lawn, that will not have problems? And the reason is because, well, because everybody's planting the same thing. And they're planting the same thing for miles. Miles is understating it. It's incredible. I mean, think about how many identical yards of St. Augustine or centipede grass there would be in a city like Mobile. I mean, the acreage is unbelievable. And here's the problem. That's just a sitting duck. It's a target. Nothing in a climate like this can survive at that scale without somebody saying, some pathogen, some insect, some disease saying, ooh, boy, howdy, look at that. I can smell the grass. All those lawns are just shouting, attack, attack me. And they're shouting it very loud because there's so much and so many of them. And that's an extreme case, but it, unfortunately, the extreme is the norm. It's just insane. So if we were talking about a lawn and we really wanted a successful lawn, it would have to be a community lawn. And this is so foreign to what we think about now. It would not be one type of grass. It would be many types of grass. And not even just grass, maybe. Maybe there would be other things in there. Like maybe you would have spring flowers. The kind of spring flowers that people go out and mow down or put herbicide on because they don't think they should be there. All of those things would make your lawn more resilient. It's interesting. Interesting how we've kind of turned things upside down. Let me tell you some examples. What we know is, and this is the kind of research I'm doing now and working with a lot of people to do. What we know from looking at forests is that big communities, diverse communities with lots of different players are in many ways more resilient, better able to manage difficulty than forests with less players. And this is just across the board. It's just consistent. It's really interesting. So we know that those the tropical forests are diverse in part because, and perhaps in large part, they're so diverse. They have so many. You know, you can go to a tropical forest. You could have 300 species of trees in a couple of acres. I mean, think about that. It blows your mind. And it's not just trees. It could be lots of other things. You can go to Splinter Hill Bog in Baldwin County. In an area the size of a beach towel, you could have 60 species of plants. I'm not talking about 60 different plants. I'm talking about 60 different species of plants in a square yard. Wow. That's nature. That's how nature works. And when we get to climates like ours, why do you have so much diversity in such a small area? Lots of answers to that question. Many answers to that question. Pathogens play a big role. And one of the things we know is that the warmer the climate gets and the more better it is at growing things and the more moisture it is available, the more pathogens there are. And that means everything else has to keep running to stay in one place, essentially. So we have diversity in these forests because they have to outcompete all these pathogens that are always nipping at their heels. This is about your lawn, folks. It's also going to be about your garden. We're going to talk about that, your vegetable garden and your flower garden. We need to have communities in our gardens. We need to be growing communities of plants. The interaction between those plants is so complex that we barely understand it now. And I'll admit, you can't go out and predict how these different individuals in the community are going to interact. But what we know is that diversity is a key. Diversity is a key to staying ahead of those pathogens. And what we know is trying to oversimplify nature, which we always try to do in our yards and everywhere else, is the first root. It is the root of most of our problems in our yards, in our gardens, and probably in our lives. So thinking about community garden, we're going to think about that a lot today. I'm going to think about it with your vegetables. How do you... No, I'm not companion planting. We're going to talk about community planting in your vegetable garden. What does that mean? I don't know. Is there a prescription? No, I'm not smart enough yet. I don't know if any of us are smart enough yet to come up with a good prescription. But there are a few instances where it helps to think about, how does nature do this? How does nature have so much diversity? And how does it use it and layer it? We'll talk about that this morning on our show. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
I left Tennessee very much alive.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Thinking about communities. Thinking about community. Thinking about diversity. And you can take that however you like it, but take it in every way. Run with it. But we're talking about yards now. We're talking about gardens. We're talking about forests. We're talking about what makes things healthy. And it's diversity. And that's hard for us. That's hard for us to understand, because we grew up at a time when the forest industry and a lot of other people were saying, you know, we need to simplify our forest. We want to really simplify our forest. We had, Alabama had the most diverse forest in North America. Incredible diversity. Probably the center of tree diversity generally, but not just the trees. Everything under the trees. We had these incredible pitcher plant box, which was diverse as any place, certainly in the temperate zones of North America. Just incredibly diverse ground layers. Just in the pitcher plant box and in the longleaf pine forest. It was so incredibly diverse, all of this diversity. And the forest industry said, this is too complicated. We're here in Memphis. We're at our computer screens in Memphis. Those who know the forest industry will know who I'm talking about. We're at our computer screens here in Memphis, and we're going to figure this thing out. We're going to make this. We're going to do it all from one computer here in Memphis. We're going to have somebody make all our decisions. We're going to treat every forest the same. We're going to plant the same tree. We're going to plant genetically identical trees all over the South and have nothing but those trees and pine straw. It didn't work out very well in the end. It made a lot of people a bit of money for a while. The people who are now stuck with a lot of loblollies that don't have the same value that they're supposed to have. And now we've got this incredible disease that's just ripping through loblolly pines. Shouldn't have taken this long. Maybe we got lucky, but it happened. We were already having problems with, you know, you're still out there worried about, you know, pine bark beetles. And you can feel free to worry about pine bark beetles, but pine bark beetles are not going to be the problem now, folks. Because there ain't going to be anything left for the pine bark beetles to eat. Loblolly's just crashing all across the state because of new diseases. And these are identical trees. I mean, they're virtually identical trees that have been planted everywhere. And I'm looking at it. You can ask me if you're seeing symptoms in your trees, because it's happening all over. Just the trees are, the new growth this time of year, it's just red. It's just, and it's brown spot needle blight or something like it. Probably just pathogens are always changing. Diseases are always changing. And it caught up and it moved quickly because we had oversimplified things. We made it a perfect target for the pathogens. And what's happened with the loblolly pines is exactly what's happening in your yards, and it's been happening for a long time. It's what's happening with crepe myrtles. We planted crepe myrtles. People say, what happened to the dogwoods? Well, what do you think happened to the dogwoods? We planted them one after another, all over creation. And then we started moving stuff around, and then we got a disease introduced, and it just went boom throughout all of the dogwoods. It's going to happen to the live oaks, too, folks. It's probably already happening in many cases on the edges, and it's coming towards us. And we got to think about that. We always want to. It's about planting a community. It's about a diversity of things. That's what we've got to think about And that's what I think, maybe if I'm worth your while this year, if this show is worth your while, it's because maybe we can all start thinking about community and thinking about communities of plants that make our gardens healthier. So, you're going to hear me talking a lot more about this. I'm liking the idea. And it's a way of really focusing on the diversity that is Alabama and why we need to be diverse and what we're going to have to do to get that diversity back into our yards and make our gardens better places. Make our gardens better places. So, you know, periodically this morning I'm going to talk about it, but you can bet I'm going to talk about it a lot this year. Am I making sense at all? Because I want to make sense really bad here. You know, here's another story. I got to tell this story. There was a study done in Europe. And they wanted, and we should do the same thing here, but they wanted to look at ticks and chiggers, well, ticks mostly, and looking at the diseases that ticks carried, and trying to see what's the difference between a simple forest, like the German forest foresters created, that were, you know, that we tried to imitate here with just one tree. And what's the difference between the tick diseases in those forests and in the simplest communities that had been dumbed down to just a few species, and the tick diseases in the communities and the number of ticks in the communities that had a lot of diversity, that were more like natural forest? And what was interesting, it was a couple of things interesting. There was a little bit of difference in the number of ticks. And that was interesting enough. But that wasn't a big deal. What was the big deal was the difference in the incidence of diseases carried by the ticks. Because in those diverse forests, the number of ticks carrying disease plummeted because of diversity. And there's a lot of people who study medical demographics, essentially, and who understand how diseases spread, who look at things like vectors, epidemiology, we call it, they will kind of understand that what happens in these more diverse forests was it supported more different kinds of creatures, which meant that diseases didn't circulate as easily among those creatures. And when we dumbed down the forest to where we had one tree, a couple of kinds of grasses, deer and mice, which is a perfect description of most of the suburbs where Lyme disease is just going berserk, everything was there to concentrate it. One of the reasons we don't have Lyme disease farther south yet is that we have so many other vectors because our forests are more diverse. Even when we try to dumb them down, they're more diverse than forests up north. And so we get things like possums, and we get things like reptiles. And do you know what things like snakes do for ticks? They basically clean a lot of the diseases out of the system. Possums are probably decently good at that too for a different reason, but yes, that's what happens. You just get a bunch of dead ends where the diseases just collapse. It's interesting. I'm thinking about all this. I'm making you think about all this because I want you to understand that diversity is really important. Diversity is really important. And it's important because when we have an environment where there's a diversity of things, we are clear to have a diversity of pathogens. When you can grow a lot of different things because the climate's right for it, because it's warm, because it's humid, because it rains, and things can grow quickly, you're going to end up with a lot more pathogens than you would have in, say, a place like Alaska. because there's just not enough time and space for those pathogens to develop. And so we have to maintain more diversity here. Diversity becomes really important to our yards. And that's what I mean by community gardening. It's more important for us to have a community of things in our vegetable garden than it is for people up north. Okay. That's the sermon. We're gonna explore it. We're gonna have some workshops here maybe this morning, a little bit if we have some time, and we're gonna explore these things. So Keith thinks I'm going overboard. All right, Keith. Maybe I am. But I'm not really. This is it. We're gonna be looking at several things. Amy said it's like a wildflower meadow. Yeah, it is. And Splinter Hill is sort of the ultimate wildflower meadow in Alabama. Absolutely incredible. There are other types of wildflower meadows that are also incredible in Alabama. We're losing them left and right. We'll talk about those. But yeah, it makes a difference. It makes a difference. All those species together. We'll be back.
Traveling through this world alone.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Thinking about community gardening. We'll be talking about how to exercise this thing, but really it's we are all very new to it because we have inherited this idea from our ancestors and I don't know wherever, and from just modern agriculture and lots of other things that really when we have a garden it can be about just one or two things. And that somehow planting a couple of different things together is going to make a lot of difference. It doesn't. It really is about a community of things. That's where you start getting things. Well, often, as I said, lawns are the perfect case. And I want to be nice about lawns, but I also feel an obligation to be truthful. You know what I'm saying? So if I'm going to tell you that you can take something like one species of grass and say, oh, it's going to do great. I like St. Augustine grass. I think it's cool grass. I grew up with it. I like the way it feels under my feet. But if you think you can take up miles and miles and miles of St. Augustine and not have it have huge disease problems, you're absolutely wrong. The thing I can say is that centipede is going to be worse. It's got to be worse. It's got to be much worse, perhaps. But for similar reasons, and then a few others. But it's that everything is the same. And it's just a perfect invitation to pathogens. So we're going to talk about it. And so some good questions. Jim this morning is asking me, one of our Jims. He's got an acre that they're trying to, let's see which Jim, if I can figure out which one this one is. No, I can't. But Jim is saying he's trying to, he's got an acre he's letting try to go back to nature, got a stand of broom sedge and other grasses, even a couple of longleaf pine babies. Adjoining property has Kogon grass. Noticed some white seed tops on my side. Who's going to win this competition? Can native stuff keep out Kogon? Only stopped mowing 2 years ago. So Kogon is one of those things. It's all going to catch up to Kogon at some point. It has to, just like it did with the loblolly pines. I don't know when it's going to catch up, and it may be a while. But we are creating Kogon monocultures where there's nothing but Kogon. And that's a huge problem for everything. It's going to be a huge problem for us, even if we don't have gardens and forests. But what's going to help? I will tell you that Kogon can invade diverse habitats. It can invade even pitcher plant bogs. It probably is a little slower when it comes into those places, but it can happen. One of the things we know, Jim, is that broom sedge is probably one of our best fighters when it comes to Kogon grass. And it is more resistant to Kogon grass than almost anything else. I do think Kogon grass is a huge problem, and I don't want to underestimate what a huge problem it can be. Particularly on the Gulf Coast now. I hope it doesn't continue to spread, but it's certainly trying. It's much worse than, I mean, kudzu just doesn't even, it's not even on the same, you can't even, on the same scale. It's just, Kogon grass is so much worse. Privet is so much worse than kudzu and the other things that we used to complain about. But broom sedge makes a big difference, and I can kind of get into why. It works in part because it works to grow in a space in much the same way that Kogon grass works to grow in a space, by basically utilizing phosphorus very efficiently and very well, and basically partitioning it all, sort of consuming it so that there's none left over for the Kogon. And on this basis, it competes with Kogon pretty well. At least a lot of scientific experiments have done that. Is it going to eliminate the Kogon entirely? No. And Jim, you might have to spot treat the Kogon. You might have to spot treat the Kogon. But when you mow, other things can affect that, and so it's good. Yeah, you should worry about seeing those little flags, and when you see them, the little white tassels, the little white flower heads that indicate you've got Kogon grass. You should treat those. But it's the broom sedge that's the best. And it's the broom sedge, really, I would say, it's the broom sedge that you want to encourage first. Because we know it can help an area recover from Kogon grass better than almost anything else. It's very effective at doing that. And it can resist Kogon grass better than almost any other plants, at least according to some of the research that I've seen done here in the southeastern coastal plain. All right, what have we got? What else we got in terms of questions? Can you talk how to get rid of Kogon grass? It's trying to invade my gardens. Roundup work. Same, it's pretty much the same answer, isn't it? But a little different in a garden. Roundup can work. Roundup can work. It's going to take multiple applications to make it work with Roundup. I will say that mowing Kogon grass does not respond to mowing very well. Unlike a lot of other grass, it's the type of grass it is. It's a C4 grass, we call it. It needs a lot of sunshine, and it does well with a lot of sunshine and a lot of high temperatures. But when you cut it, when you mow it, your lawn's going to transition to something else, generally. And you can sort of use the same principle in beds. If you just weed it out once, you're still going to have a lot of roots left. It's going to come back, and it's going to get bad again. But if you do it twice, you've exhausted a lot of its resources. So the basic thing is that you want it weed enough that you keep the sunlight. You keep it from getting too much sunlight. The other thing is it has a really, I don't know if you've ever looked at these rhizomes. It has an incredible rhizome network. It can help to pull up those rhizomes, to pull them out of the ground, get as many of them as you can, break them, you'll break up some of them, get it out of the ground, and then when they reemerge, you can either spray with Roundup, or you can weed them again, and that can make a lot of difference. The other thing to think about when you're fighting Kogon are any weeds, like Bermuda grass, which is terrible in my estimation. I mean, Bermuda grass is just a nightmare. And in many ways, I think it's worse than Kogon grass. For gardens. But if you've got a residual of Bermuda grass over in your yard and you get it out of your beds, you got to think about, gosh, this Bermuda grass is going to spread from my lawn back into my vegetable beds. So you got to stop and think about that. How do you do that? Same thing's going to happen with Kogon. So you do want to get it in the surrounding area. You got to have some kind of barrier there. It's a problem. I wish we hadn't brought this problem on ourselves. Kogon was introduced in the port of Mobile. It had a lot of names. A lot of those names are just we didn't want to blame ourselves. So we insulted other countries and other people but it was our fault. And we brought it in, and we didn't pay any attention. And then the Soil Conservation Service, bless them, decided, oh well, let's see what happens about if we plant this out. But it's become a huge issue. I hope we can find some solutions to it. It's one of three or four plants that we really need to find solutions to pretty fast. Privet is one. Kogon grass is another. Honestly, I personally would prefer we come up with some solution to get rid of Bermuda grass. That's going to be unpopular, and that's probably why we won't do it. But I hate it. What a mess, and what hard it is to deal with. It's a hard one, but I hope that helped a little bit with the Kogon grass. And I had Kogon grass in my yard in Mobile. The last yard I had, and it was a huge issue for me, but it wasn't insurmountable by any means. In fact, I think the nut sedges and the Bermuda grass were much bigger problems in those yards. But I handled both of them, and I did manage to handle the Kogon grass in every place except for in some shrub borders and some other places where it was hard to get to. But the other thing I'll say is Kogon grass hates shade. It really needs sunlight. That's always good to think about. But tell me about your specific circumstance. We'll try to tailor if we can talk about it. I mean, if I can know where that Kogon grass is coming from, if it's only in one area, if it's an early infestation, it's really easy to take care of. If it's a big infestation, it completely surrounds you, it's going to be harder. All those things make a difference. All right, let's see. What else? Phil, am I hearing you right? Do we have some callers?
We do. Did I get that? Actually, we have. I believe it's Jim on the road, Mobile, with Kogon grass.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Jim. I'm listening. What's up?
Hey. Good morning, Bill. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Good. I texted you about the Kogon grass, and then I was listening to your response there, and got me to wondering, this area, it had plenty of beautiful muley grass and all of that, and rubeckia and various things, and by not mowing it, do you think it might be better with the Kogon grass to knock it back and actually mow it on occasion, now and next time it sprouts up or whatever, or what do you think on that?
Any way you can reduce the sunlight that Kogon can get, you're going to damage the Kogon. If you mow your whole yard, you're going to end up with bahia grass or something else.
Yeah.
So,
well,
and that's,
you know, Bill,
that's,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you. I agree with you there. I was just trying to make sure that I could somehow keep the broom sedge and not harm it.
Yeah, and Jim, let's talk about that. Let's give me just a second. We got to have this little break.
Sure.
If you can hold on, I know you're driving. Drive safely.
I can.
But hold on, and we'll come right back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, Jim, are you still there? Are you still? Can you still hold on?
I am, Bill.
Yeah,
I am.
So let me tell you this story real quick, and this will give you some hope. Mobile Botanical Gardens. We decided to create to recreate this longleaf pine forest. We had most of the ingredients there on about 30 or 40 acres. And if you haven't seen it, you should always go by and take a look at it. It's really beautiful. We decided that was a really important part of what we should be doing there. And the forest came back. So did Kogon. And as we cleared out the magnolias and other junk that had gotten in there over the years, because it wasn't a natural system anymore, where we cleared out the magnolias, boy, the Kogon just took over. It was amazing. It's like I could almost find where the magnolias were. And one of the reasons it took over so quickly there was because those magnolias had created a place where there was nothing else. And so the first thing to invade was the Kogon grass. But over time, what we decided we would do, and John Olive has been in on this from early on, was to use Roundup to spot treat for the Kogon, and it worked very well. It worked very well. There were some other mixes that were used in there that I didn't like as much, and I don't think it's necessary, but that has worked very well. And you know what we got? We got tons of broom sedge. We got tons of other grasses as well. And we have very little Kogon grass, or at least the last time I looked. So it can work very well just doing these little spot treatments. So what you want to do is, when you see those little flowering heads, you know, ooh, I got to mark that. You can put a flag on it and come back. You can treat it right away. But it makes a ton of difference if you do that. And you just, you spot treat that one area. You get a little backpack spray with Roundup. You can even get a squirt bottle, theoretically, and that might work just about as well. And just hit it.
Yeah.
And while you got a little bit, it's going to be relatively easy to deal with.
I got you there, Bill. Yeah, I'm practicing that sort of thing up in the country where I'm headed today, up to Greene County, Mississippi. But yeah, you know, and just anecdotally for me, I go up and down Rangeline all the time, and south of the industrial canal there's this big distinction. It's like somebody drew a line and said, okay, Kogon grass down into the ditch where they mow and maintain, and then everything to the ditch to the tree line is thick, lush broom sedge. And I can't help but think some of that came back. That's a state aid road, and I think, you know, every once in a while they go through this idea that they want to spray it and kill everything. And,
right.
And, you know, used to be Bahia, which, you know, Bahia, okay, but it wasn't Kogon. But now it's like a white border on both sides of that road. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And so, but I think it's also a testament to the fact that broom sedge resists the Kogon pretty well. Not perfectly, but better than almost anything else. And so if you can give it a little bit of a hand, it'll make a ton of difference.
Thank you, Bill.
Jim, good talk to you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's the thing. And it is, I mean, I just have to say, we do create problems for ourselves. I wish we did it with Privet. We're continuing with Privet. You know, we could probably be controlling Privet right now, except that there are people in the nursery industry. Okay. I'm still here. There are people in the nursery industry.
Apologies.
No problem, Steve. And there are people in the nursery industry who want to keep selling Privet because it's easy for them to grow and sell. But it's a huge problem. I mean, it's a devastating problem in parts of Alabama. I mean, it's having a huge impact on turkey. It's having a huge impact on deer. You know, I guess nothing's having an impact on deer. That's a lie. Not even hunters have an impact on deer because they shoot antlers. But it don't worry about the deer. But, you know, it's a big thing for turkey. It's a big thing for quail and a lot of other things. And Kogon grass is bad for them, but so is Bermuda grass. So we've got to think about these things. And these are all things we introduced. These are not things that are native to us. Our problem is rarely do we have a problem with what's native here in Alabama. Our problem is with the things, with the crazy stuff, the insane stuff that we introduce in most yards. It's just huge. I don't know. I'm trying to think of a major weed that I get calls about all the time that's native. Yeah, but you know it's not all the time. But I do get calls about Smilax, and Smilax is native. I actually like Smilax; it's a cool plant. But it can drive you crazy at times. But it's not like Kogon. I mean, it doesn't really interfere with your garden. It just makes you cuss just a little bit because it's got thorns on it. And blackberries are native, some of them anyway. Not all of them. Some of the worst ones are not native. But I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, our real problems are the ones we introduce, the ones we bring on ourselves. That's another story. What should Aldot do about the miles of highway where there's Kogon grass? Yeah, so you would have to change your management, wouldn't you? One of the things you would have to do, and this is something that we really should consider, is mow once a year. I guarantee you that in many areas where we're mowing repeatedly, the we're encouraging the Kogon. We're not mowing enough. So you could either mow all the time, like once every week or two, like every 2 weeks. And if you did that, it would be incredibly expensive on the highways. And you would probably reduce your Kogon. Or I think you could, I would be interested to see if just mowing once a year wouldn't make a difference, because it would tend to encourage some of the clump grasses, like broom sedge, to do better under those situations. But I guarantee you the mowing regime now, it is a perfect mowing regime for Kogon grass. Perfect. And so I think altering the mowing regime could make a big difference. It could make a real big difference. What do you think about that? Our opinion on that is not affecting Aldot. It takes Aldot as like, it's like shouting down into the bottom of a well, and you don't even know if anybody's down there or not. But yeah, that I think that could make a lot of difference. There's some other things we could be doing in terms of what we're planting there. You know, one of the other things that Aldot should be considering on some parts of the highways, I don't know why nobody does, and I'm just going to say it out loud right now, is, you know, there's no way to make the highway median or even the highway margins natural. There's just too many weird things that have been done to those areas. So it may be better to think, what can we do here that actually benefits people without doing harm to the bigger environment? And maybe that's solar panels. I'd get rid of the Kogon. All right, we're going to be back. We got lots of good questions. I've got to get to this palm question, too. All right, Robert, I'm going to be looking at your palms.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Howdy, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. We've had lots of interesting subjects this morning. I'm researching some of the questions that I have. There was a question about a palm, and let's talk. We talk briefly about palms this morning. We'll talk longer if you want me to, if you have other questions. And then we're going to come back to this idea of community planting. But palms. So someone sent me a picture of a palm last week, Robert, I think it was, and it had some lichen growing on it. And I said, not worry, that's not a big deal. Lichen is not actually using the palm for anything other than a base. It just kind of hangs out there. Doesn't extract anything from the palm. It could be lichen grows on brick. It grows on. It's like an algae. It uses sunlight for its nourishment, not the plant itself. The plant is just a platform for it to sit on. Doesn't hurt it. But he was also worried about cracks in the palms. And let me. And it's interesting. We don't understand that palms are not like trees. Palms are more like corn. They're more like grass. In fact, well, they're monocots. They're not in the same group of plants that trees are in, dicots. And so they function very differently. And you might want to pay attention to this. And I know I'm getting a little obtuse here. But listen, let me tell you about palms. A tree has a little narrow area called the cambium. Right underneath the bark on a regular old tree, and all of the nutrients in that tree move up through that little slice of cambium. It's just a little fraction of the tree. And the inner part of the tree is dead. It did nothing there. It's just dead wood. It's dead even when the tree is alive. Isn't that weird? It's bone. Well, let's just call it bone. But it doesn't even have the function of bone. It doesn't do anything except form a structure. The cambium is the active part. The cool thing about a tree is that cambium can keep growing. It doesn't get necessarily much wider, just fractionally wider, but it spreads out. And the dead part in the center expands, it grows because it captures where the old cambium was. So if there's a lot of damage to a tree trunk right on the surface, if there's a lot of cracking, you kind of worry about that cambium being exposed, and you worry about the living part. It is more of an issue. But here's the thing about a palm. A palm doesn't have a cambium at all. In fact, a palm has something called pseudobark. It doesn't have true bark. It's a skin, but it's not like tree skin at all, and it doesn't have a cambium. The whole inner part of that palm transfers moisture up through the tree and nutrients up through the tree. The whole inner part of the palm is alive, unlike the inner part of a tree. Now, this has a lot of interesting implications. You'll notice that palms really don't get a lot bigger, don't get a lot wider as they get older. They just get taller. I mean, if there's a bad growing year, they'll kind of be a little inset where it. But the fact of the matter is, once you have an established diameter for a palm, it never changes. Do you think about that? And the bud at the very top, if you actually do any damage at any part of that tree, whereas, you know, a tree might be able to recover from if you take out some branches at the top. When you remove the bud at the top of a palm, it's gone. Because that's the only growth, that's the only place it has potential for growth. All that's really interesting. But here's the other thing about a palm, is the cracks don't matter. So let me get back to your question. It's a fundamentally different thing than a tree, and your palm, those cracks don't matter. Why do those cracks happen? You know, you'll hear a bunch of different stories. And I think
it probably happens more to the palms as we move around. And it's probably got to do with, I don't know, some expansion or other things, but it really isn't usually a sign that something bad is about to happen to the palm. None of the stories that I hear about why the cracks develop fully make sense. I mean, all of them may have some merit, like, oh, it got too much moisture too quick. Nah, it doesn't make any sense, really. And it dried out. I'm not sure that makes sense either. I think there probably is some stress in moving a palm around, and maybe that can make, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, those cracks don't seem to make any difference at all. So, Robert, you're okay. You're just fine. I think your palm will do fine. It's the top of the palm that you want to look at. That's where the problems are going to show up, not at the base usually. There are some termite issues we have with palms. I don't see any evidence of that here, and that's something to worry about at times. It's probably more of a, those problems are more of a problem in, I'm thinking probably more of an urban situation where it stays warm all the time and creates an ideal environment for those termites to, particularly Formosans, to move around in the tree trunk above ground. But I don't see any problems like that. Don't see any butt rots, but you would see problems at the top. That's where you would see the problems if there was an issue with your palm. You're okay. You're okay. All right. Let's see here. Okay, got some new pictures. Yeah, so there was some damage. There was some damage done to oh dear, let's see here. Let me cut this off just a second before. There we go. It looks like there was a little bit of damage done to the palm. And I see that now. And it probably that was bruised in the move. But there's not a thing you can do about that at this point. And the likelihood is the palm will go ahead and live. Just don't keep whacking at it. Don't use a weed whacker around it. Don't damage that bark anymore. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Is it possible to girdle a palm? That's an interesting question. It probably doesn't work very well to do that, but I think your palm's going to be okay. I think there probably was some damage at some point, but I think it's going to be okay now. So that's my final assessment, and I think you're okay. All right. Drewski sent me some pictures about needing some IDs. So one is a lupin, and it's our native lupin, Velosus, Lupinus velosus. What is the common name for that one? I don't remember, but it's the purple lupin that you see in longleaf woods. You said it was in the Delta, but it wasn't actually in the Delta, was it? It was in the woods that are sloping up from the Delta. We used to have a lot more of those woods. We've just about destroyed them all by either building steel mills or building suburbs. And I think the suburbs are ahead of the game here in terms of destroying the land around the Delta. But they grow in very dry, sandy areas. Lupinus velosus. Gosh, if somebody, it's not, you know, we got a great name for the other lupin that grows in those areas, sky blue lupin, which is really beautiful. Really beautiful, much prettier than the blue bonnets people go to Texas to see. Really stunning looking things. Your blueberry is a little harder to diagnose from a picture, but I am going to say, well, I'm going to wait just a minute, and I'm going to say in just a minute when we come back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Okay, what am I going to say about this vaccinium, this blueberry, these huckleberries? Let's start off. Drewski, I got your I've got your lupin nailed there. So Lupinus villosus, it's what we got. It's a cool plant. L-U-P-I-N-U-S, V-I-L-L-O-S-U-S. There's got to be a, I don't know what the common name is, but really we probably don't have local common names for these things. It's like, I don't know what happened. It's like we just forgot to give things names. And that, by the way, I like to remind people, is a violation of Genesis 2. Those of you who believe in that, in the Bible, you have, that was a commandment. That was an order. You got to name these things, buddy. And ma'am, if you will. We don't do it. We do a terrible job of naming things. We just do a terrible. We would never be perfect, but we don't even try. It's bad. So we don't have a lot of common names for these kinds of things in the modern world. But we got that Latin name. You could look that up. Your blueberries and huckleberries. So here's the name thing. Huckleberry is a name that I think may have been popularized by, guess who? Mark Twain. And it has caused confusion ever since. Huckleberry was just a local name for a blueberry. And it's probably, the word huckleberry is probably related to an old European word that probably is maybe pronounced something like whortleberry. Whortleberry. It's an old Anglo-Saxon word, and which is sort of a blueberry from Europe. It's related. So we borrowed this name. It became huckleberry in the U.S., and it probably was used in a few places to refer to all blueberries. And then Mark Twain wrote a book, and then we had already named these other things that are in the woods blueberries, but then we had to figure out, well, what's a huckleberry? And so we had, it just got really confusing. Let me just say, huckleberries and blueberries are the same thing. There is not a good way to distinguish huckleberries and blueberries in the common, as they're used in the common language. There is no way. They're the same thing. There are a couple of different genera of blueberries and that are huckleberry blueberry group, and I won't go into that because that'll just confuse you more. But the ones that are generally edible, the ones that we generally eat in the South, they're all blueberries. You can call them huckleberries just fine. It's okay, but they're all blueberries. We have, and I didn't count. I meant to count, and I was just on there to count. How many, goodness gracious, Alan Weekly, let me see what he's got. I think he's got like 30 species of blueberries that we got to worry about. Yeah, something like that. 14, 25. I think about 25 maybe. Goodness gracious, there's a bunch of them. And so it's in the South generally, and maybe more if you include the huck, what the other genus, Gay Lusatia. So figuring them out is difficult. I'm going to say that the one you're looking at, I can tell you, I can tell you that it is not Elliot's blueberry, which would be really easy to tell. I was kind of hoping it was, because then I'd say, ah, boy, it sounded like I knew what I was talking about. That's Elliot's blueberry. I'm going to say it's not Elliot's blueberry. It's probably one that is called, maybe it's Fuscatum, Vaccinium Fuscatum, and which used to be lumped together with Corymbosum and some other things. You have to look at the leaves and the hairs and the glands on the leaves, and then you can kind of look at the mature fruits and tell things. Based on that, I'm going to call yours Vaccinium fuscatum. Do you think Vaccinium fuscatum has a common name? You're wrong. It's not a specific common name. We just call it blueberry or huckleberry. And it's maybe call it the big black, one of the black blueberries, the purplish blueberries, because it does seem to have a darker fruit. If it has a light, bright fruit, much like the rabbit eye, then I'm saying it may be something like Formosum or something else. But I have a feeling this one's going to turn out to be very dark, that the berries look blackish. So I'm gonna say it's fuscatum. They're all really fun to eat. And they all have slightly different flavors. It's fun, but it's good. I'm glad you got it. Does that help? Do we call it Alabama Piney Woods Lupine? Lupin, whatever we, however we say it. Well, we could. I think the sky blue lupin is better. Why not? Probably in Alabama, it mostly grew in areas that were in one way or another piney woods. There's just several lupins that grow in the piney woods, and that makes it harder. So we got the sundial lupin, which is really beautiful, Nuttall's lupin. And we've got the sky blue lupin just over the line, and we've got this lupin. And the hairy lupin, maybe that's the name. I don't know what the common name is. And then you got West Yanis over in Florida, and several others over there. It gets really interesting when you start looking at these lupins. All right, that was fun. That was our figuring out what the plants are this morning. What else have we got that we need to come back to? I guess. The question Don is asking about how important are dragonflies for things like, so dragonflies are really important predators, but they're mostly predators. They're at their best as predators, Don, when they're in the water, when they don't have wings, when they're actually on the water bottoms, they eat a ton of mosquito larvae. And they don't have wings there. They're waterborne creatures. They kind of have. I haven't thought about it. Do they have gills? I don't think so. They have some means of surviving in water, and I'll have to look that up to figure out what it is now that I've made myself ask the question. But they survive in water without wings, and that's where they do the most damage to mosquito populations. When they are flying around, they are kind of going for mosquitoes, but they're probably not as all that successful. They're much more successful when they're in the water. Isn't that cool? I love dragonflies. We got a lot of them. Really nice thing to have. Let's talk about this community thing just a little bit more, because we're talking about community planting. And I'm trying to understand why a place like Splinter Hill is so successful. With so many different species packed in such a small area, it's very efficient. So, and like a really diverse forest, what do all those species do when they work in tandem together? One of the things about Splinter Hill, and one of the things I think we can take home to our own gardens that's pretty readily apparent, is there are just some mechanical benefits, simple mechanical benefits to living in a diverse environment. And one of those is the one I've already alluded to. So you got grass, it's planted everywhere, it's the same grass species everywhere. You got loblolly pines, it's planted everywhere, the same loblolly, not just the same species, but probably literally almost a clone, planted out everywhere. Well, what happens? Boom, you create a target, and boom, when disease happens, it spreads from one plant to another just like that. Happened with dogwoods, happened with crepe myrtles. It's going to happen with live oaks, tree to tree to tree, limb to limb to limb, nothing else, but you create a problem. It helps, even in a small garden. And I think we don't have the science to fully back it up, but we know it works at multiple scales above and below the scale of a garden. So I don't know why it wouldn't work in a garden. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence in traditional cultures when the Cambodians first came here and before they adopted Western ways and brought their ideas about gardening, it was clear that they understood that having a diversity of plants in a small space was a good thing. If you go to Mexico and you look at the traditional gardens there, it has a diversity of plants in a small space. There is sort of the same thing happening with other cultures too. I think what we used to call three sisters, which is squash, corn, and beans. It's sort of the same thing. But having a diversity of a variety of things in the same space is very helpful. Break your yard up. Plant things in small groups. Don't feel like you have to plant them in long rows. We'll come back to that in just a minute.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, okay. Well, I decided I'd look it up. So the Lupinus villosus, the lupin we were talking about, that beautiful lupin, is sometimes or apparently referred to as Lady Lupin. I don't know why. I'll have to think about that. I'm not sure why. It's called the pink sandhill lupin. That's fine. That's fine, too. Or the hairy lupin. So, at any rate, and then we've got the beautiful sky blue lupin as well, Drewski. And we talked a little bit about dragonflies, and I wanted to emphasize that it's the young'uns that make a big difference. The young'uns we call naiads, but they don't have wings. They live underwater. They eat a bunch of stuff. They even eat tadpoles sometimes, but mostly they're eating invertebrates like mosquitoes and things like that in the water. Wigglers, as my mom used to call them. Gave her the heebie-jeebies to see wigglers in the water. Those are young mosquito larvae that also live in the water. And so there's a lot going on before those guys hatch out that you want to think about. So we're talking about diversity, and we're talking about community planting in the garden and how useful it is to have a diversity of things. And sometimes you do want to plant things in groups, like corn, for example. You got to kind of plant it in groups. And it's very beneficial to plant it in groups. But, you know, because it has to cross-pollinate, because insects don't transfer pollen from one corn plant to another. Did you think about that? It's blown by the wind. And so those plants have to be in close proximity to get good pollination. And so one of the things that the First Nations did, the first people to exploit corn on the continent, was to plant it in circles. But you don't have to plant all the circles together. In fact, you can plant things between those circles, and you can scatter those circles, and that's probably really good. It's probably really good to do. Greg, I am so glad you want to talk about this. Greg has called. Are you still there, Greg?
I am.
So tell me, let's talk about it. Catalpa. What you want to talk about catalpas for?
Well, I just planted 10, and I'm kind of new at it. I'm trying to get them started.
Great. And do you know which kind of catalpa it was? Where'd you get them from?
I got them through a friend of mine that bought them from a man in Loosedale that he raises them, and of course my friend has already raised the worms last year, so I'm trying to get them started on my farm.
Yeah, that's right. So these are great. I love it, and you know it's we don't really realize that catalpas are native to a very small area in Alabama and Mississippi. And not much anywhere else. Maybe in Georgia, maybe in Louisiana as well. And I think that's the one you have, having come from Loosedale. I think catalpas are the coolest things in the world. I think they're really beautiful. I think the leaves are beautiful. I think the flowers are stunning. But we don't grow them much anymore, and we should. And where are you going to take these worms fishing, Greg?
Probably in the Delta.
All right. What do you think? I'm picking your brain now. What do you think? Is it good for bass, you think?
Well, catfish is what we use them for, but I think anything down here.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think they're great for brim, too. And I think the brim will often bed up under catalpa trees when they used to grow along the rivers. And I think there's probably a reason for that. But they love the worms. So for folks who don't know, catalpa worms are famous for fishing with. And you grow these catalpa trees, which are great trees. They're beautiful, wonderful trees. And then you get the worms, and the worms, they defoliate the tree. And you're in a total panic, and you say, oh, my goodness. But you know what? Those worms are great for fishing. And they don't really hurt the trees. They've kind of evolved together, and they're all kind of happy about it. So it's a good thing. And sometimes you have to help the worms find the tree. But it sounds like Greg's already got that figured out.
Well, my question is, what's the best fertilizer for this tree?
Tell me where you're growing it.
North Baldwin County.
Okay, what's the soil like?
It's kind of sandy. Maybe a little clay in it.
So I don't think you really need to fertilize them. We fertilize trees that aren't native and that have been fooled with, and I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference, honestly. I think mulching helps a lot. What makes even more of a difference is making sure that the roots have an easy time expanding into the soil around them. So if they have to compete with a lot of grass, it makes it harder for those roots to expand. If the soil is compacted for a distance around the tree, it makes it harder for those roots to expand. So it's good to use a fork to kind of crack up around the plants if you've just planted them, just to make sure that they can move easily, and then mulch, but not right around the trunk. What you want to mulch is where those roots, you want those roots to grow, and you want those roots to grow about 8 feet out from the tree. So anything you can do, if you get bags of leaves and other things, just pile it around those trees, not right around the trunk, but out. You know, leave a space about 2 feet around the trunk, and then just pile those leaves, and I guarantee you that'll be all the nutrients they'll ever need. They'll be fine. There is evidence that actually catalpa trees use catalpa worm poop, like a number of other trees, to actually grow on. So it's a great way for them to convert to get a quick dose of nitrogen. So as the catalpa worms are growing on the trees and filtering down, dropping all that poop, it's probably beneficing the, so it's fertilizing a catalpa. Isn't that bizarre to think about? But those catalpa worms are actually fertilizing the catalpa. And it's a good, quickly available form of nitrogen that the tree will use. So what you really want to make it do is just make it comfortable, make it sure those roots expand. And I think they're going to be fine. They used to grow along streams. Greg, I don't know if you want to know all this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. They used to grow along just streams. You'd almost never see them except along gallery streams, where you still do in many places in Alabama where the streams are more or less native and we hadn't boogered them up too much. But they would grow just along those streams, on the levees along the streams, sort of overhanging the streams. So they don't like to be wet. They don't like to be sopping wet, but they like a good bit of moisture, and they like a lot of water flowing through. And they don't like to dry. You know, I think they don't grow as well if they dry out too badly. They're pretty tough, but they don't like to grow as well if they dry out too badly. So I think having that mulch is also very helpful where that's concerned as well. So I'm excited about your catalpas, Greg.
Well, I got a friend of mine. He's got 27 going now, and I got 10. So we're going to try to see what we can do with them.
Yeah, well, it's good. Keep me posted. I want to hear how they do. How big were they when you planted them?
About 3 to 4 foot.
Yeah, that's a great size. That's a perfect size. That's a perfect size. And I'm going to guess this is the Alabama Mississippi native one, Catalpa bignonoides. It'll be about 30 feet high at the most, and that's great. It makes it a lot easier to pick the worms. The other one, Catalpa speciosa, gets to be about 50 to 60 feet, and it's a lot harder to pick. So, but you're doing great, and it sounds really good. So keep me posted on how they do.
Okay, Bill, I appreciate it.
All right, Greg, good talk to you. Chris, is Chris still on the line?
Yeah, Bill, I'm here.
Chris, I'm listening. What's up?
Yeah, sure enough, I've got a lane about 300 feet long, got drainage ditches on both sides, but it's in an open field, stays wet most of the time. I'd love to have the lane lined with willow trees. I can't put willow trees, you know, every 20 or 30 feet without spending a couple thousand dollars, so I got some cuttings from CZ Grain out of, I think, Iowa. And the cuttings, I put them in water. They started sprouting real nice. Here, this last week, I put them in the ground with just some garden dirt. And my only concern, I'm watering them once or twice a day, but the very top inch of each of these cuttings is turning black or brown. And I've seen where a couple of the small limbs have died off. What might I do? I've sprayed them with neem oil yesterday. Any other thoughts?
Well, the neem oil won't help at all. You can put that aside. You know, they're struggling to make it. Do we know what kind of willows these are?
Weeping willows.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
It.
All right. So weeping willows don't do well in the South. They're very short-lived. I suspect most of them will probably survive and grow. You may lose a few, but most of them will survive and grow. They will live, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. So plan for something else to put there when they all collapse. So.
This is an all-day project.
Yeah, I know. So I wish I could have talked you out of it before. But I can't change willows. They are what they are, and weeping willows are what they are. They have a lot of problems in our climate. I don't recommend them. The wind breaks them up really easily. But, you know, a lot of times they just don't live long enough for even the wind to break them up. They grow fast, and that's a good thing. They'll probably grow pretty fast. And then they'll die young. But so just plan on something else. There's nothing wrong with the tips of those dying back. Probably,
okay,
given the fact.
Okay, I even sent you a picture.
What's
that?
Did you get my picture? I did not. I have not yet. Let's see if it's come in. Let's see here. Sometimes pictures. There it is. Yeah, no, it looks healthy. Oh, it's great. It's going to do fine for a while.
Okay.
And it's fine. So it's just where it got cut off, a little bit of rot. It'll be fine. So they're going to sprout mostly from the base.
Right.
And even as the top gets rotten and browned out, it's going to keep sprouting from the base. Willows are really good at doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a willow that got all broken up. It was in a yard that I purchased, and I had to get rid of it, and I'll come back. Give me just a second. We got to take a break, and we'll be back.
I'm
tell
here.
That story.
Sure. Thank
All right.
you.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Lots to talk about, apparently. Chris, let me tell you about the willows and how tough they are when the cuttings are tougher than the trees. And that's your good news. So we cut down this willow because it was getting all broken up in the wind. It was looking terrible, and it short-lived anyway. So but very fragile weeping willows. And so we cut it, and I knew it was going to sprout like crazy, and it did. And then we cut all the sprouts, and then my wife was going to use and they just kind of laid there on the ground for months. And my wife said, oh, well, we need some pea brush. Pea brush is what you use when your peas grow up and you want something to climb on. We'll use it. And I looked at them. Those things are still green and sprouting. They are just tough as nails. And I've used native willows before on restoration projects, and they're really good. So black willow is a really cool willow. It lives a little bit longer. It's still brittle, and I don't recommend it in places where you're driving your car or your house. Excuse me, but it's a cool tree, black willow is, and I've used it, and it's very easy to start from cutting. So those cuttings are tough. You're going to be surprised. And you're going to get a lot of willows that will come up on your drive, and it will be, you're going to be really happy for about 5 years.
Well, all right, after 5 years, where would I go after that?
Well, let's start thinking about what you're going to do for 5 years from now. So let's figure out something that would make a better LA that won't cost too much money. It all depends. How long is this? How long is this LA going to be?
How long is what?
How long is the path that you're lining a driveway, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so how long is it? Some people call that an LA.
300 feet. It's about 300 feet. I've got them planted 20 feet apart on both sides.
Yeah, so that's not too many trees. Boy, there's so many fun things you could do.
Well, I thought willows would be one of them.
Yeah. Well, willows, yes. Well, yes, they're going to be good for 5 years. You're going to enjoy them for 5 years. So I'm trying not to take that away from you. So, and then we need to think of something else. I mean, do you like fruiting trees, for example?
Oh yeah, of course. If it can handle wet.
If it can handle wet, it's a wet spot. It's a wet spot. So, you know, for wet spots, things that would last a long time and that are quite beautiful are things like bald cypress or pond cypress would both do really well there. I like a tree that that people don't grow as much. It's called water tupelo, and it's the tupelo that sort of was made famous by Van Morrison in his song Tupelo Honey, She's As Sweet As, for example. So it makes a great honey. But I like tupelos, and they're pretty easy to grow. They're a little harder to find. The cypress are not hard to find, pond cypress. And so you could slowly begin planting out some of those pond cypress, which I think are more attractive. There are some oaks that'll do really well in that situation too. So you could actually start some oaks from acorns if you find the right trees that would do really well. Like overcup oak would do really well in a situation like that and would be really pretty liney. It's got a white oak bark, got really pretty leaves, and would do really well in that wet situation. And you could start those from acorns. And you've got a five-year head start to do it. Yeah.
Look at your messages right now because I just sent two more pictures. And one of them is with about a dozen bald cypress that I put in another wet area. So I'm a step ahead of you there.
Yeah, all right. So let's try to find an overcup oak, and because you'll like those. They're really pretty, and it'll give you a little diversity in your planting. And once you find the acorns on Overcup Hoak are unmistakable. The little cap, the acorn cap, covers most of the nut. So that's why it's called Overcup. Just a little bit of the acorn sticks out from the cap at the bottom.
Okay.
So if you can find somebody to help you find an Overcup oak and get acorns for that, boy, you know, those acorns are easy to start. All you got to do is put them in pots right away as soon as you get them. Put two or three in a pot, and then weed them out, and you're going to have some great Overcup oaks in a short order, and you're going to be ready to plant those out, and those would be really cool. I could have fun. You know those catalpa trees that we were just talking about? Did you hear me talking about the catalpa trees? They tolerate wet soils.
I don't like the worms. By matter of fact, I got ponds out here that the fish would probably love, but I hate when they get decimated by the worm.
Yeah, but it's only a brief time. But okay, so there you go. Yeah. So, we can't do catalpas apparently, but we can do. But the oak will be really nice, and I think you'll like that oak. What others? There's just a bunch of other, and it's a long-lived oak. It's a nice long-lived oak that'll be really good. Even Michaud's oak, the swamp chestnut oak, the so-called swamp chestnut oak, which you'll see sold by nurseries, is a really good one too. And it'll do really well in those situations. So there's a lot of fun trees out there, that you could use in a wet situation like that. And we're going to get off the phone and I'm going to think of a bunch of others.
How about I'll give you a call next Sunday, okay?
All right, great, Chris. Thank you. All right. Let's see. Jarhead, man, it's good to hear from you. You know, Phil says you're going to talk about Amarillos, and I'm thinking, he's either going to talk about plantains or he's going to talk about cheap cigars. But, you know, I bet you're not going to talk about either. I bet you're going to talk about armadillos.
No, actually, it's Amaryllis.
Oh, really? Amaryllis. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm just reconstructing this. Good.
Good. I inherited some from a neighbor who recently passed away. Of course, they're all in pots, and they're all in bloom right now. But what do you do with them after they bloom? How many times will they bloom?
So you got them. What do you do with them after they bloom? Well, you want to fertilize them a little bit. You know, a lot of Amaryllis, Jarhead, do really well in the ground in our climate. And do you remember Taxman? You've been around long enough to remember Taxman. Loved Amaryllis, and he had them in pots. He had them in the ground. He had them everywhere. And we always argued about when was the best time to transplant them and all that kind of stuff. But I think right now, after they bloom, is a fine time to just put some in the ground if you want to, and that's kind of an easy way to manage them if you've got a good spot for that. They can do really well in the ground here, and they'll be usually almost all the varieties are going to be hardy, and you'll get really good bloom out of them. If you keep them in pots, you basically do the same thing every year. Occasionally you'll have to you'll let them go dormant. When they go dormant, Jarhead, we're run out of time. You got to call me back next week, Jarhead. We got to talk more about it.
Will do.
All right, good. All right, folks. We'll be back next week. Have you ever